there's a new movie out filled with pulpy violence, quirky stars, and smart, funny dialogue.
Said they were looking for a little shih tzu. Then some other punk killed those punks. It's their blood. It's his puke.
So you might be tempted to call the director sort of an Irish Tarantino, but don't.
I guess I don't really like being compared to anybody else out there.
Today in Studio 360, I'll talk with Martin McDonagh about his new film, Seven Psychopaths. It's got blood and guts, but also lots of heart.
I don't think I could put a film out there that was purely about guys with guns shooting each other and car chases and have it be an empty genre flick.
And wouldn't it be awesome if the presidential candidates had campaigns you could sing along to?
We're gonna fight to keep our president in the White House where he belongs.
I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion was started by a small team that was passionate about an idea for a different kind of car company. And now Scion wants to help others follow their passions. The Scion story is at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
I'm Kurt Anderson. Today in Studio 360, we'll look at the pop hit that made Los Angeles the poster child for kind of a national bad habit.
Walking in LA. Walking in LA.
Everyone drives here. You can't go anywhere. They take their car wherever they're going. I'm going to go to the bathroom. Yeah, here, take my car. Okay, thanks.
Nobody walks in LA.
The story, Walking in LA, is later this hour in Studio 360. But first, let's talk about an art heist, a big one. The Kunsthal Museum in Rotterdam in the Netherlands was in the middle of celebrating its 20th anniversary last week when a few burglars broke in after hours. They made off with seven paintings worth tens of millions, possibly more than $100 million. Monet, Picasso, Matisse, Lucian Freud, and they did it in under 5 minutes. Anthony Amore is the director of security at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. He's also the co-author of a book about art theft and speaks widely on security issues. Anthony, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt.
So you've watched this video, this amazing security video of the heist in Rotterdam. From watching it, to me, it looks like it was so easy. Like it'd be harder to break and enter some Walmart somewhere. Is it as amazing as it looks that these few thieves could pull off something like this so easily and quickly?
I agree with you. I mean, when I watched it, it's remarkable for the ease with which this theft occurred. Most people would expect to see something out of a Hollywood film a little more complex.
Say we get into the cage and through the security doors there and down the elevator we can't move. And past the guards with the guns and into the vault we can't open.
Without being seen by the cameras.
Oh, yeah, sorry, I forgot to mention that.
We're just supposed to walk out of there with $150 million in cash on us without getting stopped?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But this is how art crime usually occurs. It's a bit mundane. However, the video screams to me that there's insider information provided to somebody to commit this crime. They got in so simply and were in and out so quickly with the pieces that they had to know that they'd be able to get in without any interruption and walk out with them in less than a minute and a half. That's incredible.
And you would go with the theory that they had inside information rather than their brilliant Steve McQueen's?
Yes, it's very rare, or it almost never happens that these are brilliant Steve McQueen's or Pierce Brosnan's. It's your typical mid to lower level type criminal.
And is it clear that there were some correctable lapse in their security setup?
Yes, I would have recommended overnight guards. You should always have people in the facility, even if they're just there to help, you know, also insure against fire and water damage to the art. The police arrived within 5 minutes, but that was about 3.5 minutes too late.
So yeah.
You need to have people on site. It's a good deterrent as well.
Well, it's interesting. Instead of, massive laser matrices that we see in movies to protect things, you're just saying a couple of guys.
Yeah, you know, it's a couple of guys, but as a layer. You know, it seems to me that this museum lacked layers of security, because once the thieves penetrated this seemingly easily penetrated door, there were no layers between them and the art to protect it. So once they got through that one layer of security, it was a fait accompli, and that's never a good recipe for security.
So the big question always in art thefts like this is, what do you do with it? They can't just go sell it. It's either ransomed or it's valueless. What do we think will happen now?
Well, there is a couple of other options. First, you're right. I mean, you can't just go sell these things. Oftentimes, art thieves, history has shown that they are short-sighted. They suppose that they can steal these and sell them, thinking, well, these are worth many millions of dollars. If I got pennies on the dollar, I'm still going to get a king's ransom. However, there are no buyers out there for things like this that are highly recognizable. The other things that could happen with them, though, is they could be held as a bargaining chip for someone who's a career criminal, who anticipates if they're arrested down the road, they might use these to barter for a lighter sentence.
Huh.
And sometimes also they're used as collateral in the drug trade. The one scenario that you rarely, if ever, see over the last century is, you know, this Dr. No figure who enjoys this in his underground lair.
Yeah. The collateral in a drug deal, how would that work?
One of the scenarios would be that, you know, when you're sending drugs one way and sending a large amount of cash another, you would want some sort of collateral. And using these paintings as such would tell the other party, yes, number one, you're a serious player, and number two, you risk exposure by giving these paintings forward. And thirdly, they do have some value in terms of cachet in the criminal underworld. So that's how they could be used as collateral.
Unlike many big crimes, art heists seem to frequently go unsolved. The criminals unapprehended. There's the famous case in Boston 22 years ago at the Gardner Museum. Do you expect these guys to get away with this?
I expect that the paintings will be recovered. However, there's a pretty decent recovery rate for masterpieces, and Picasso's, Gauguin, Monet, Matisse, you're talking about masterpieces. Typically, you see that they're recovered either in a very short time frame, in the first couple of years, or after a generation has passed.
And when it's a couple of decades, is that usually the case that the thieves get them, then sit on them, don't know what to do, and finally they just lose interest and say, oh, well, here, world, here's your art back?
Sometimes. The other more likely case is that the scariest member of the gang who was involved is dead, and there's less fear. There's also statute of limitations, considerations that people wait to pass. So there are a number of reasons why. In the scenario where they return quickly, it's because maybe somebody snitches on the thieves or they just mess up or realize their folly and return them.
Anthony Amore, thanks so much for talking with me today.
It's been a pleasure, Kurt.
Anthony Amore is co-author of Stealing Rembrandts, The Untold Story of Notorious Art Heists, and director of security at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. You can see video footage of the heist in Rotterdam on our website. That's studio360.org. The presidential election is barely a week away, thank God. It seems like years we've been barraged by campaign ads, and if you live in a swing state, you have my condolences. The ads themselves, zero flair. There's nothing very creative, nothing memorable for either candidate. Before the election's behind us, we wanted to see if we could spruce things up, so we launched our presidential jingle challenge.
We need somebody in Washington with bold solutions to get things done. So don't just sit there, let's put me there. It's time for a conservative Republican.
We're gonna fight to keep our president in the White House where he belongs. We're gonna celebrate his victory, doing cartwheels and singing songs. He's the one to choose if you wanna keep the unemployment rates going down. He's a man who knows how to keep a foreign policy from crashing to the ground.
Write and perform an original song that makes the case for either guy and submit it at studio360.org. The deadline is Sunday, October 28th. Coming up, Martin McDonagh was just 27 when he hit it big, huge, as a playwright in London, which certainly surprised him.
Well, I definitely preferred films to plays, and they were too expensive for me as a kid, and they were just too boring as well, because I grew up in England, and we see a lot of boring plays there.
The playwright and filmmaker, Martin McDonagh, he's up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion was started by a small team that was passionate about an idea for a different kind of car company. And now Scion wants to help others follow their passions. The Scion story is at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. If Martin McDonagh were a fictional character, his story would be a little over the top. Raised in London by Irish parents, a construction worker and a cleaner, he drops out of school at 16, goes on the dole, and then writes a half dozen astonishing plays in just a year or two. And voila, in his 20s, McDonagh has four shows running simultaneously on London's West End. Then he moves into filmmaking and immediately wins an Oscar for his short movie Six Shooter, then a Best Screenplay nomination for his first feature in Bruges. Martin McDonagh's latest movie is Seven Psychopaths, and it's got his characteristic blend of comedy and violence. It stars Colin Farrell, Sam Rockwell, Woody Harrelson, and Christopher Walken as four guys who end up in situations like this.
Put your hands up.
No.
What?
I said no.
Why not?
I don't want to.
But I've got a gun.
I don't care.
Doesn't make any sense.
Too bad.
Oh, and now I see him here, and he's also good-looking and fit, so he's just got too much going for him. Martin McDonagh, welcome to Studio 360.
That sounds like a good life. Thank you for
having me. It does sound like a good life. Are you having as much fun and pleasure as that all sounds like?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I never, ever imagined that I'd even have one play on, let alone be able to make a bunch of films. And as you said, I dropped out of school pretty early and was a working class kid in London, and those avenues weren't really open to someone like me, I thought. So, yeah, it's kind of been a bit of a dream to come this far and to do this much work.
Seven Psychopaths is about this drunken young Irish screenwriter in L.A. named Marty, played by Colin Farrell, who falls in love with the title Seven Psychopaths, which is the movie he is trying to write, and then finds himself just casting around somewhat pathetically to come up with a story.
Pathetically, but handsomely, I thought.
Very handsomely. Well, speaking of which, it's not an accident that he shares your name, some of your background, some of your profession. How autobiographical were you?
Some of my drinking issues.
Really?
No. No, I think you throw a few truths in there along with a bunch of red herrings when you're doing a script that's kind of meta, for want of a better word.
It is that.
Yeah.
And yet for all that meta-ness, it never remotely becomes pretentious. Is that a thing you think about?
Very much so. I didn't want it to be. When you're getting into meta themes, you just don't want to end up smug or feeling like you're smarter than your audience. It's actually not a fine line. I mean, it's you have to think about the balance quite a lot.
Two things propel this plot: Marty working on this screenplay and his best friend Billy, who's played amazingly by Sam Rockwell, kidnapping a gangster's dog. I want to play the scene in which the three main characters all get together for the first time, and two of them almost get shot.
What the hell happened?
Some punks jumped us and said they were looking for a little shih tzu. Then some other punk killed those punks.
Marty, are you okay?
I just didn't need this today.
He's okay. It's that blood. It's his puke.
You want to go to the bathroom? Clean some of the blood and the puke off of you?
Marty's my writer friend I was telling you about.
I can smell the booze.
Scenes like that and other things in this movie will inevitably, as the reviews come out, make people compare you to Quentin Tarantino. How do you feel about that comparison?
I always like Pulp Fiction. I think we all do. And Reservoir Dogs is amazing too. I guess I don't really like being compared to anybody else out there.
But if only in the making, people who don't have any idea what this is going to be have a sense of the neighborhood, probably that's mm-hmm. a useful thing.
Probably. The Quentin's earlier stuff, I guess. It's all Coen brothers or people of that ilk.
Now, it wouldn't, I guess, be a Martin McDonagh work without this alloy of comedy and horrific violence.
I guess not.
Yeah. Pretty consistent. Was this always your sense of what was entertaining, even as a kid?
I don't think so. I mean, I love, Preston Sturges and Billy Wilder as much as I love Peckinpah or, any of the more
violent. Right. So you merged them.
Yeah, exactly. I don't see it. I see it more as a combination of comedy and tragedy all in one. But in this one, I guess I wanted to explore film violence and question it a little bit.
The Woody Harrelson horrible gangster character has this dog that he loves, and his love for that dog drives the whole plot. The protagonist of The Lieutenant of Inishmore had that little
cat. Yes.
Who was a major character and astonishingly a real cat on stage.
Yeah. I think you should steal from the best.
Yes, so. Exactly.
Or conversely, I think you should just rehash the old material.
Well, obviously you're interested in the idea of these stone cold violent guys who are just pets.
I guess it's kind of a critique of the sentimentality of male violence in some ways. As one of the characters says, you can kill 100 women in the movie, but you can't kill a fluffy dog.
Do you ever feel like you'll write it out of you and say, and just make make things that have no gunshots in them whatsoever?
Rom-coms. I'm planning on a rom-com where no one dies.
Really?
Yeah, or very few people.
Huh.
But no, I'm not. Sorry. I think this is as far as I kind of want to push the envelope of violence, certainly in movies.
The plot does, as we've said, involve gangsters and serial killers and a terrorist. It's really a buddy movie. Right?
Pretty much, yeah. The whole story kind of revolves around Colin Farrell and Sam Rockwell's characters. Even though the things they're saying might be outrageous and crazy and, hilarious or whatever, and even though they might be doing quite dangerous or scary things, their decency, their love for each other, for want of a better word, should be palpable throughout.
And the sweetest, sanest, apparently, psychopath, which is the Christopher Walken character, is their sort of father figure, I guess.
To a degree, yeah. I think in some ways, I think Chris's performance is amazing in the film, but he's kind of like the moral through line of the whole thing, the beating, the moral heart.
Let's listen to the three of them as they're heading out on their road trip in the latter part of the film.
As Gandhi said...
Oh, you too. If it ain't Gandhi... Jesus Christ.
An eye for an eye leaves the whole world blind. I believe that wholeheartedly.
No, it doesn't. There'll be one guy left with one eye. How's the last blind guy gonna take out the eye of the last guy left, who's still got one eye? All that guy has to do is run away and hide behind a bush. Gandhi was wrong.
It is so not, among other things, in any way a kind of, I get what this is. This formulaic Hollywood three-act, beat here, pipe here, 25 minutes, this happens. do you begin just refusing to play by those sort of stale rules?
Yeah, I think so. I think never having studied and being kind of stupid helps with that too.
You are self-taught in all ways.
Yeah, plays and the films. When I started this, I didn't really know where it was going and I didn't really particularly want to say anything. I just had what Colin's character has at the start of the film, the title, maybe one psychopath, and an idea of taking it into realms of love and peace and Gandhi and pacifism, and knowing that that was funny to have a film by that title and aiming to go to that place.
You grew up in London, but you're considered an Irish writer, even though you don't sound Irish. Mm-hmm. Here. But you set those first six plays in Ireland. Does Irishness feel like a part of who you are in some deep, important way?
It's to a degree, yeah, I think so. Although at the same time, I've always been kind of anti-nationalistic. So when I was, you know, starting out, I mean, my mum and dad are Irish, and they came over to England to find work and had me and my brother over there. But they were always, you know, very proud to be Irish, and so that would be surrounding
and
us.
And returned.
Yes, returned about 20 years ago. So that was always there when I was growing up. And then when you start, I guess, making a name for yourself, you kind of try to pin you down as to exactly what you are.
Yeah, yeah.
London Irish is always kind of the closest to what I've sort of seen myself.
Right, which is a particular thing.
Yeah. But I've never, like, British would never be something that I could ever describe myself with.
Really?
I think because of the colonial kind of aspects of that word.
You can't get over that, huh?
That would be the Irish half that can't.
And did you go to church? Were you raised Catholic?
Yeah, till about 13 or 14 or so. I think that kind of runs throughout the work, especially in Bruges. There's a lot of Catholic guilt.
Well, there's
that.
A lot of talk of, is there a heaven in this?
In this, too, yeah. And I find those themes pretty interesting. I still like, you know, wandering into a church now and then on my travels and having a sniff.
You were quoted once, even before you made movies, saying that you preferred writing screenplays to stage plays.
Well, I definitely preferred films to plays,
You mean as a viewer?
As an art form. Well, I just wasn't brought up on plays, and they were too expensive for me as a kid, and they were just too boring as well, because I grew up in England, and we see a lot of boring plays there.
Given now that some of the greatest work being done in pop culture is on television, if the right channel that does these good shows came to you and said, Martin, make a show for us, would you?
I think because I'd want to control like every episode and write every episode, I don't think, and they have to be like 24 episodes long.
No, not on the HBOs. You can do 6-8 a year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, good. Done. Deal done. Martin McDonagh, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been great.
Martin McDonagh's new movie is Seven Psychopaths, and it's open now. Back in 1982, a new wave pop band called Missing Persons hit it big on the new cable channel MTV. But it was another Missing Persons single from 1982 that took on a life of its own, became a meme before people used that word all the time. It was called Walking in L.A., which, the song says, nobody does. If you do walk in L.A., that could get annoying after a while, especially if you make a living thinking and writing about urban planning in walkable cities, like Alyssa Walker.
6 years ago, I decided to give up my car. This would not be a feat worth mentioning except for the fact that I live in a place where most of the world believes that not driving is physically impossible.
Other people are actually, get this, they're actually walking in Los Angeles. That's pretty rare here because a lot of my friends, at least, get in their cars to go two blocks to buy some coffee. So a pretty car-dependent town.
Here's the problem. A song that was written 30 years ago keeps getting stuck in people's heads. It was 1982, and Missing Persons painted a really bleak picture of sidewalks populated with losers and shopping cart pushers, where people are only walking because they ran out of gas.
Hey,
The way I see it, people use Nobody Walks in L.A. as shorthand for life in Los Angeles, a handy pre-packaged reaction for someone to spit back at me when I tell them I arrived on foot. Los Angeles is actually not the worst city for walking. According to the website WalkScore, which ranks cities by their walkability, it's 13th in the country, just behind Portland, Oregon. Portlandia! According to the U.S. Census Bureau, in 2011, 4% of Angelenos walked to work. Another study used by city planners reported that 17% of all trips in Los Angeles County are done on foot. I decided to track down the guy who started this mess. Terry Bozzio was the drummer for Missing Persons, and he wrote the song Walking in L.A. The band broke up in 1986, but he's still making music.
Hi! How are you?
I met him in his recording studio.
Just as I expected you to be in this in this gigantic drum.
It's in an office park in the middle of a strawberry field in Oxnard, about an hour outside of L.A. It was a little too far to walk. I had to drive a car. I asked Terry where he got the idea for the song.
In the 70s, you know, Johnny Carson was the big TV show, and all the New York comedians would come to his show here in L.A., and they would always talk about that topic. So it was just, you know, every week you'd hear somebody saying, nobody walks out here, you know, David Brenner.
I'll tell you what I miss the most in Los Angeles. The thing I miss the most is walking, because I've been here 2 days, and the longest walk I've had is from that curtain to this spot. No one walks out here. It's against the law. You get arrested if you're caught walking in Los Angeles. Like, what's that man doing moving his legs like this? What are you, a pervert? Get him in a wagon. Everyone drives here. You can't go anywhere. They take their car wherever they're going. I'm going to go to the bathroom. Yeah, here, take my car. Okay, thanks.
Okay, so maybe it's not Missing Persons' fault after all. Terry's the first to admit that the band didn't have an agenda. The song wasn't this calculated attack on walkers.
For us, it was kind of just a tongue-in-cheek observation, you know, meant to be a comedy payoff from, you know, the build-up. I mean, certainly not a deep song.
Then why won't this song go away?
One of the most stubborn stereotypes about L.A. is that the people who move here have less of a desire to walk than people in other cities, and I've always thought that was ridiculous.
That's Christopher Hawthorne. He's the architecture critic for the Los Angeles Times.
I think what's different is that the city doesn't lend itself to walking. It often makes it difficult for people who walk.
Los Angeles once had the best public transit system in the world, with a massive network of trolleys. But in the last 50 years, LA began prioritizing cars over walkers. Streets were designed for speed, sometimes without sidewalks.
As the 20th century wore on, we kind of redesigned our boulevards almost to make them like miniature freeways. We made them friendlier and friendlier to cars.
So if you could update the phrase nobody walks in LA to be appropriate for 2012, what would you update it to?
Everybody wants to walk in LA, secretly or not. Some people don't like to admit it. And I think the question is how much the city is going to respond or even respect that desire in the future.
So if the phrase nobody walks in LA is out of date, then it's time for a new slogan, one that shows the city the change we want, one that expresses we're kind of fed up.
The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the 210.
And then I heard this song. The singer, Eddie Solis, vents his rage against the numerical codes of the L.A. freeways. The 210, the 605.
The 101, the 405, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5.
Eddie's a singer and songwriter from East L.A. I met him downtown on a subway platform.
The message is, you know, get out of your car, it can be done.
Eddie's song is raw, angry. This could be a new kind of anthem. The pop song to get us off of our freeways and onto our feet. But a funny thing happened as I was reporting this story. Over the last few months, the city finally started to listen to its walkers. Last month, the city of Los Angeles hired its first ever pedestrian coordinator.
I'm Margo Ocañas, and I am the pedestrian coordinator for the city of Los Angeles.
In fact, they hired two. I called one of them, Margo Ocañas.
When engineers look at the public right-of-way, traditionally they have used striping, signaling, and signage simply for the purposes of moving cars efficiently. We are now bolstering what I would call their policy or design handbook with a series of stripings and crosswalks and signaling that are actually put in place to ensure the movement of pedestrians. And we will be launching a program that will allow communities to submit applications to have either a plaza, a parklet, or a bike corral put into place in the right-of-way within their areas.
This is the answer I was looking for. The city is finally reclaiming its streets for pedestrians. So maybe as part of the city's campaign, we take back the missing person song. It's the perfect critique to this whole stereotype of not walking. I proposed this to Terry Bozzio, the songwriter. He gave the idea his blessing.
That would be great. Why don't people walk in LA? Why is that? You know, how come?
And as the writer of the lyric, Nobody Walks in LA, you do think that people should walk in LA?
Yeah, only in a safe, well-lit area and with a gas mask.
For Studio 360, I'm Alyssa Walker.
You can check out the slideshow Alyssa put together from some of her favorite walks around L.A. at studio360.org. And while you're there, the songwriter in that story, Eddie Solis, took it upon himself to write a car-free punk anthem just for us, which you can hear at studio360.org. Coming up, a German inventor who dreamed up an extraordinary new instrument. And he wrote some pretty good music, too. You may have heard of him.
Bach's music seems to fall well onto all sorts of different instruments. It seems to work its way into different contexts and remain Bach. It doesn't get dumbed down. People don't have to popularize it. It is what it is, and yet there it is on the soundtrack of Master and Commander or some other movie, and it fits perfectly.
Reinventing Bach. That's coming up in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion was started by a small team that was passionate about an idea for a different kind of car company. And now Scion wants to help others follow their passions. The Scion story is at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Here's an impertinent thought. The world's great symphony orchestras and chamber groups are really just cover bands. They play and we listen over and over again to performances and recordings of performances of familiar hits by famous composers. And yet, somehow, all those endless repetitions and reproductions don't sound like copies of eighth-generation Xeroxes, do they? In his fascinating, fervently personal new book, Reinventing Bach, Paul Eli tries to figure that out using the music of Johann Sebastian Bach as the ultimate case study. He looks especially at the ways that performers of the last century, Albert Schweitzer, Glenn Gould, Yo-Yo Ma, keep teasing out the new in Bach's 300-year-old music. Paul Eli, welcome to Studio 360.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So we will talk about the various versions of reinvention more, but your title, Reinventing Bach, how over these 300-plus years has Bach been reinvented?
Bach called invention a foretaste of composition, and for Bach, invention was a way of working up the music just elaborately enough that it was distinctly itself, but could be carried forward by others into places that maybe the composer hadn't expected.
There was an open source aspect.
Exactly, that shareware.
And that has happened with Bach's music more than other composers of the 18th or 19th century?
Bach's music seems to fall well onto all sorts of different instruments. It seems to work its way into different contexts and remain Bach. It doesn't get dumbed down. People don't have to popularize it. It is what it is, and yet there it is on the soundtrack of Master and Commander or some other movie, and it fits perfectly.
This isn't just a gig, an idea you had in midlife. You fell for Bach.
That's right. After college, I listened to obsessively to WKCR, the Columbia University radio station, mainly for jazz and partly because I just didn't have any money. That was free culture. And every Christmas they abandon the airwaves. They leave jazz behind and play Bach for a week straight. And that was a super saturation in Bach. And by the end of a couple of those Christmas marathons, I knew what I liked, and I knew I would not look back.
In one of your many day jobs, you write a lot about and think about religion. Was this, I mean, it sounds like in the colloquial sense, it was a religious experience. Was it in any sense a religious experience?
Definitely. The important thing to say, though, is that it wasn't, I don't separate out the religious aspect from other aspects. Bach is so musically persuasive that the religious aspect of his work, the fact that he wrote liturgical music, that he wrote Passions for Holy Week, that was something that had to be investigated because I knew what my ears were hearing and I knew what it was doing to my body, to my mind.
And I don't know. We haven't taken a poll, but I would guess that a large fraction, if not a majority, of people who listen to and love Bach today and other people who wrote liturgical music in the past are not believers. Therefore, when I hear something like the B minor Mass, which I adore, is it wrong that I am loving it for reasons entirely detached from Bach's intentions?
Not at all. First of all, it's not really understood what Bach's intentions were. There are people who say that it was a crypto-Catholic Mass for this German Lutheran. Others who say that it wasn't understood as a Mass except in some sort of abstract sense. Others who say he was just adroitly repurposing music in the way of an efficient artist. So we don't know what he was trying to do. Can't really say in a few words what religion is, but one of the things that it certainly does is connects people in a very direct way to the past or to a sense of the past. And most classical music is old music.
Right.
And then when you compound that by hearing a 200-year-old work in a 50-year-old recording, you're having an experience in a kind of triple time that I think it's fair to call transcendent.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of the particular historical aspects. And Glenn Gould and his performances of the Goldberg Variations have this, speaking of religion, this almost religious, fetishistic aspect in classical music and among Bach lovers. And you, I mean, why the Goldberg Variations? Why are they such a big deal?
For people of Glenn Gould's era, I think they were an introduction to many people to Bach. On top of that, they did something for Bach that it's not fair to say hadn't been done before, but hadn't been done in a way that was widely distributed. They connected Bach to post-war churn, to the fast tempos and sleek lines of a lot of 50s culture. Glenn Gould couldn't be less like Bach in some respects. He's a solitary Canadian, not a German father of 20, and yet he made it work.
Recorded this originally in 1955,
right? June 1955.
And when you say he is somehow embodying the post-war moment, explain what I should be hearing when you say that.
He's not playing in the way of a romantic artist with lots of vibrato, with lots of pregnant pauses. There's a detachment and an objectivity, almost a mechanical quality to it that I associate with skyscrapers and jet planes and elevators and things like that.
the book becomes this interesting history of the evolution of 20th century recording. Describe how you connect these very different players, Schweitzer, Pablo Casals, Glenn Gould, to this idea of perpetually transforming technology.
After the Depression, suddenly the cost of a phonograph went down. Radio really emerged in every nook and cranny of American life, and recordings were everywhere. And these traditional artists in their 60s began to take full advantage. Pablo Casals, who'd mastered the cello suites as a teenager but had never recorded the whole set, went to EMI Studios in Abbey Road to make a recording of the full set because, the way I argue, he finally had at his disposal the means to make a recording that captured the solitude of the music that was the whole point of it as far as he was concerned. Here's a 60-year-old cellist, and instead of poo-pooing the new technology and saying, I don't want any part of that, he gets with it, he goes and makes a state-of-the-art recording, and it still sounds fantastic today.
And your argument is not just that, I can make a few bucks and put out a new record, that there was a musical rediscovery going on here and that he was enabling with technology.
I think so, that if you were a cellist before Casals' time, you had the music to yourself unless you played in a recital hall. If you were a listener and you wanted to hear Bach's cello suites, you had to be the cellist or be a prince who employed a cellist or be married to a cellist. And suddenly, there's a record that enables you to bring the cello suites into your living room. That gives you access to the solitude of the music in a way that you're just not going to get if you have to go hear it in recital.
And as a result, in the 300 years of different interpretations through different technological eras, are there examples where you really see, that's a 1900 version. Oh, that's a 2000 version.
Yeah, the differences in Bach's and the interpretation of Bach's music are all over the place. It's especially noticeable in the vocal music. If you take the St. Matthew Passion, the famous recording by Klemperer from 1961 in London, he's got a double choir with several dozen singers in each of two choirs. Conductor Dame McCreesh has a recent version with fewer than a dozen singers in all, and they're like a couple of doo-wop quartets on different sides of the studio. Music is the same. The tempo is very brisk in one, very, very stately in the older recording. So you've got giant chorus and stately tempo versus fleet tempo and compact aggregation of musicians, and it's a profound difference.
Do you have a favorite piece?
No single favorite piece, but the piece I keep coming back to lately is the Well-Tempered Clavier in different interpretations, harpsichord, piano, old piano versions, new ones, partly because, and I hope this doesn't sound heretical, you can either give it almost mystical attention or you can put it on practically as background music or driving music, and it seems to work either way.
Well, we will listen to that as we go out. Paul Eli, thanks so much.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Paul Eli's book, Reinventing Bach, is out now. Here in Studio 360, we are always up for hearing your stories about any works of art or entertainment that mean a lot to you.
My name is Mary Miller. I'm from St. Pete, Florida.
A couple of years ago, Mary Miller was in love. She fell hard for a guy who worked in real estate. He flipped houses for a living.
When I met this gentleman, he represented all romance. He had traveled down here on the intercoastal waterway on a boat, and he was going to travel the world. And he made his money in order to do this by taking houses and turning them around and selling them for five times what he paid for. And I fell in love with the romance. I fell in love with the idea that I could live my dreams of traveling the world, live on a boat. And then we broke up. I gave my heart to this guy. He trampled it. And I was going to teach him a lesson that I could go out there in his world and make the kind of money he'd made and make a name for myself. And I didn't even own a drill to flip a house. I had something to prove, though. I had something to prove. I was in my car on the way to the bank to sign a loan for $400,000, and this song came on the radio. And I heard Leanne Womack sing.
And when you get the choice to sit it out or dance, I hope you dance. I hope you dance. I hope you never.
And I was sitting in the comfy bank chair. I had the pen in my hand, and I'm ready to sign the dotted line for $400,000 in home equity line of credit, which seems ridiculous because at the time my income was less than $20,000. And I heard the lyrics in my head.
Don't let some hell-bent heart leave you bitter.
Don't let some hell-bent heart leave you bitter.
Reconsider.
When you come close to selling out, reconsider. And I just sat there with the pen in my hand. I just finally put it down and said, I can't do this.
I hope you do.
As it happened, within a year, the whole housing market totally crashed. And I would have lost everything. I would have lost every dime had I signed that dotted line. It was over. It had been over between me and this fellow, and I had to let it go. And it was the best thing I ever did. Oh, thank you so much. I put my money into music equipment, and my singing had just taken off.
Welcome, everyone, to our show. I'm so happy to be here tonight.
Ooh, Dean. Oh, Dean just puts me in the mood. Now I get to sing in retirement communities, and I have so much fun. I love it.
Oh, it's just going to be so much fun tonight because these are the best of the business.
We'll be singing together Harry Belafonte, Matilda, and the Banana Boat song. Goofy stuff, that's amore. Their faces light up, all the cares drop away from them, and that takes them out of the pain and suffering, the loneliness that can come to all of us. That's what music does. And for me to be able to enjoy that with them, it's the greatest gift. What I learn from these folks who have lived into their 80s and 90s is pretty similar to what Leanne Womack sings about in her song, I Hope You Dance. Living might mean taking chances, but they're worth taking. And loving might be a mistake, but it's worth making. They teach me how to live, how to take risks, how to be true to myself, because life is short. One day you'll find that the time has passed, and when you get the choice to sit it out or dance, that's it.
That is Mary Miller. She listens to the show on WUSF in Tampa. Studio 360's Jenny Lawton produced our story with help from Eve Asher. Has some piece of music or book or movie or other work of art ever changed your life? If so, tell us about it on our website, and we might put your story on the air. That is it for this week's show. Thank you so much for listening. Next week, we'll pick a winner for our presidential jingle challenge, and you've got until Sunday night, October 28th, to send us yours. All the details are at studio360.org. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel, Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Alina Kuczynski,
Matt Leibowitz,
Jesse Taylor.
Special thanks this week to Jennifer Sendro, and thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion was started by a small team that was passionate about an idea for a different kind of car company. And now Scion wants to help others follow their passions. The Scion story is at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Are you tired of watching TV pundits yammering about the election? Well, go spend some quality time on the internet.
I got protesters saying our economy
closed.
And my
Wall Street brothers
one.
Occupy
close.
I got 99 problems.
It's not one.
How political video mashups go viral. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.